Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. America has experienced the Great Depression and the Great Recession. Now add another economic experience, the Great Hesitation. This is exemplified by companies prolonging the hiring process, which is making it harder for people to get jobs. This is happening in many fields, including the tech sector, which was once considered a sure thing in the job market. George Denglinger oversees U.S. technology marketing and legal talent solutions in the Robert Half Consulting Firm, and he deals with this every day. Welcome to All Sides, George.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So the Great Hesitation, it's a new phenomenon when it comes to job searching. Can you talk to me about this hesitation and making it harder to find a job?
Sure. Well, you know, and certainly this year, most have described the market as a dynamic market. There's a lot going on in the market. I think, first of all, when you think about the tech sector in particular, it's important to state right up front, unemployment rates remain very low in the technology sector, about 3.1% unemployment, 3.1%. And that's below the national average for unemployment. But in the tech sector, the external economic uncertainty and some of the evolving government policies are just causing a lot of hesitation in the hiring market. When you think about job seekers in an uncertain market, they're less likely to make a career change, right? You're not going to leave a secure job for a job that maybe, while it might be a job that you're interested in, maybe it's less secure because you're the last one in at that company. And employers similarly are hesitant to commit to kind of longer term hiring decisions and expand their staff because they're uncertain. So all of that, we're calling the Great Hesitation, which is a noticeable slowdown in job movement.
Now, tech jobs were once considered a sure thing. If you went to school for tech, you were guaranteed to find a job out of college. Is that no longer the case, or is it just a little harder?
It's absolutely a little harder today. Mm-hmm. Some of that is non kind of specific to the technology world. But some of it is specific to the technology world. And I think, certainly, I'm sure that there's always questions around AI. There's there's some projected impact, maybe not today, but projected impact on certain technology roles and jobs that, maybe have contributed to some of that slowdown. The data that we're seeing right now is very early, right? It's very, very early and emerging around what specific roles within technology will have the most impact. But, there's no question that some really basic level coding jobs, for example, AI can be used to do those jobs. Are companies using AI to do them? Some big companies have come out recently and talked about how they're using AI for those roles. But, certainly small, mid-sized companies are nowhere near that.
So you mentioned AI. Is AI taking some of these jobs, or is it that people need to know they need to have the AI skills and maybe they're lacking in that area, so therefore then they're not qualified for the job?
I think you're the latter.
Okay.
For sure today. Certainly there's very specific AI jobs that are out there, data scientists, et cetera, that are available. And we kind of have seen early on, we believe the current point of view is AI will actually create as many jobs or more than it may replace long term. And we've seen that over decades with technology. But I think your comment and the point, and we talk about it, AI is not going to replace your job, but somebody that knows AI may. And so for, how you use, and that's not specific, by the way, to just technology, right? Think about any job in almost anywhere. AI has a potential use case within, virtually every job out there.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking with George Denglinger, who oversees U.S. technology marketing and legal talent solutions in the Robert Half staffing and consulting firm. So AI in this current job market, are we needing to teach it more? Because I just did a show last week. Ohio State is now requiring all incoming freshmen to take an AI fluency course. Is that going to fix it? Or is it, I mean, AI is much more complicated than just taking an AI fluency course.
Well, it certainly is not going to hurt, right, to have some familiarity, understanding of the platforms and of large language models in particular, and in the different ways that AI can support you in your day-to-day life, and that includes in tech jobs. I think in AI, the interesting thing that we've seen, it's more of a skills gap than a jobs gap. And individuals that have AI-related skills, kind of going back to our prior discussion, that seems to be, the gulf right now that many companies are trying to fill. All of our research continues to indicate that there is a lack of skilled tech talent out there for companies. But it's certain AI-related skills that maybe they're lacking, rather than the kind of traditional IT employee to fill kind of a traditional role.
We here in Central Ohio, we're building data centers. There's one being built by Intel, and there's constant talk of needing the workers, the right workers, to be able to fill the jobs once all of these data centers are built and operational. Is that the type of job that involves AI as well? So we need to train these workers in for the jobs of the future.
Certainly, and it's certainly very exciting. I spend a lot of time in Ohio as well. What we're, you know, it, some of our recent statistics, and I'll throw a couple numbers out at you. So our recent report that was referenced in the Great Hesitation article, 76% of technology leaders report skills gaps in their department. 44%. Those they indicate those are AI directly related to AI, machine learning, and data science. But I think that the second one really stands out to me. 40% say they have skills gaps in their IT operations and support centers, and 30% in cybersecurity and privacy. So for those IT folks out there, the infrastructure jobs around operations, cybersecurity, all of that, all the work, you need all your data in the cloud to be able to kind of leverage AI. There's a tremendous amount of work and a lot of repurposing that folks in those infrastructure jobs with some fundamental basic training can quickly migrate into those job opportunities.
Now, universities and colleges are not known for pivoting super quickly. Sometimes they do, but they're big institutions. It takes a long time to develop a new course. Can't where are we going to learn all this from? Is it on the job training, or where are the skills coming from?
So amazingly, there's a ton of online certifications, courses, testing that you can take, many of it free, and many of the big companies, Google, Amazon, and others are offering online certifications and online classes. Many of those are free. The proliferation of little tutorials and tests that you can take to kind of level up and pick up some of this is almost endless right now. And so, one of the things I love to suggest to people is use AI to learn AI. So, go to your favorite AI platform, type in what you're interested in to learn a little bit more, and ask for free classes certification, and you'll be absolutely amazed at, again, I said just the volume of opportunities and kind of courses that are out there. Many of them, again, are free.
The article that called this time the Great Hesitation in the tech industry also mentioned the lower level IT professionals. Are they still needed? The people who are just helping in an office space fix computers and upgrade windows and that kind of thing.
So far, yes, the human component has not been replaced, even in the lowest, the most transactional, the way I always talk about it, right? Those transactional jobs. Now, there are certainly emerging technologies even before AI. When you think about desktop support, when you think about your own kind of help desk, even in your company or mine, a lot of those fundamental basic jobs have been, we're leveraging technology, including AI, to be more efficient with those jobs. But our thought is that all of those roles, the individuals that are doing those roles, will just continue to level up into other roles that require human interaction, and that kind of human compassion for, you know what, you're having trouble with your computer, let me help you kind of thing. That's what we've seen so far. Again, we do see there'll be some impact, but I don't know that we think about it a whole lot different than Ailey than we've thought about the impact of, old manual spreadsheets to Excel, years and years ago. It didn't replace the work, it just raised the level of the work that the individual did.
In those percentages you gave me a few minutes ago, one you mentioned was cybersecurity. You said 30% of employers say the applicants are lacking cybersecurity skills. I would have thought that number would be higher. Cybersecurity seems so important and evolving and changing every day. I mean, there's new ways of hacking left and right.
I agree. I think that when you think about 30% cybersecurity and 40% on the IT operations side, but a lot of that stuff's connected. When you think about you need to level up your IT operations, your infrastructure, in order to be able to have good security, good privacy compliance across your whole organization. A lot of cloud architecture and operations work flows into that. So some of this, interestingly, is you need to kind of do the first level work before you can do the second level work. And one of the things I talk a lot about is that many of the companies that we're working with and that we help from a staffing perspective have a lot of what I call tech debt. And I mean, that's very simply just old systems that they can't leverage new technology, such as AI, because their data's on old systems. Think of some of even the airports that get in the news, right? They're using old mainframe computers to process very complex algorithms. Well, that's not going to work too good. You've got to upgrade the old system. So I think your comment is a good one. But a lot of the work right now that we're seeing for both large and even mid-sized companies is in that foundational work around updating their architecture, getting good data hygiene, getting good fundamental data. And now you can think about things like advanced cybersecurity, privacy, et cetera.
I also wonder if the people who were taking your survey, the CEOs of these companies who said that only 30% were lacking cybersecurity, maybe they just think that they are very secure until they get hacked. They don't realize.
Perhaps. And it's always one day away, right, from
Right.
something happening. So that's a, I don't disagree with that.
Let's talk for a minute about the future of the Great Hesitation. Are we going to have these tech jobs that are out there that are sitting, that basically they're taking a long time to fill these jobs because they're not sure if they need the job, they're not sure if the people have the right skills. But then also there's the salary component. Can you talk to me about how much in on average people are making in the new tech jobs?
Well, and it's broad-based. We do publish our salary guide every year because you've got certainly a lot of roles in here. Maybe I'll respond to that. Overall, when you look at average salaries for tech jobs compared to average wage inflation and salaries in the broader marketplace, tech jobs continue to have higher salary inflation year over year than kind of traditional, more broad-based. We're looking at around, overall somewhere between 6 and 8%. And I'll just caveat there, there are regional differences in all of this, right? Some regions there's different, the wage inflation is different in maybe Ohio than it is in California or in Florida, for example. So, I would certainly direct folks to our salary survey. You still are seeing wage inflation. Wage inflation in tech jobs exceeds many other traditional type of jobs. So that's good news when it relates to, kind of the increase in wages. Some of that is tied to the type of work that's being done by IT workers. As you move kind of, as we've had this discussion about, the job becomes more substantive, less transactional, obviously those more substantive jobs potentially pay more.
How long is the Great Hesitation going to last as AI grows and we need, and it's in every part of our lives because it continues by the day to grow. will there be more jobs to be had and maybe the great hesitation will be over?
Well, I would love to say I could forecast the future, like all of us. I have a point of view. When we talk to our customers, we see a tremendous amount of pent-up demand. And you mentioned things like a Windows upgrade. You know, many companies are running on prior versions of Windows that they have to upgrade eventually. Many software platforms are requiring they will no longer service or provide updates to old non-cloud-based versions of their software. So there's a lot of things that have to happen at companies that I believe is a lot of pent-up demand. That pent-up demand was caused by both external uncertainty, which we've referenced, but also some internal uncertainty around kind of what's the future of some of our tech stack and what we want to do from a technology investment standpoint. To answer your question directly, I believe that, you know, many of the companies I'm talking to, if they get kind of a whiff of economic certainty, and whatever that means, that's different from everybody, I think you'll see a pretty significant movement on spend in and around technology initiatives.
We've been talking about the great hesitation, why it's getting harder to get some tech jobs, with Robert Half Consulting Firm's George Denglinger. Thank you so much for joining us on All Sides, George.
I had a great time being here. Thanks so much.
Coming up, we're going to talk about some of the technology behind the U.S. bombings in Iran. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
Businesses that sponsor WOSU find a loyal audience that trusts public media. When your business is a WOSU sponsor, you break through the noise of everyday advertising to plainly say, we care about the things you care about. Honest reporting, advocacy for the arts, clever entertainment, and civil discourse. Your business can use WOSU TV and radio, our website, and newsletters to reach this potent audience. Learn more at wosu.org/support.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. And I have to say, what's unfolding in the Middle East right now contains all three of those elements: science, technology, and the future of our environment. We're watching in real time as the U.S. and Iran react and respond to the U.S. bombings from over the weekend, when stealth bombers dropped 300,000-pound bombs on key nuclear facilities in the country. Joining us now is Robin Wright, an expert on Iran and the Middle East, which is the subject of several of her books. She's also a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Her recent New Yorker article, published before the bombings, is titled, What is Israel's Endgame with Iran? Welcome to All Sides, Robin.
Nice to be with you, Amy.
So help us catch up on the latest developments. Yesterday, Iran launched missiles to a U.S. military base. There were no reports of casualties. Then President Trump announced that there was a ceasefire. And then there's comments this morning that both sides violated the ceasefire. It's a fragile situation. As it unfolds, what are you paying attention to the most?
Well, the big issue going forward is really, can the United States broker a deal with Iran that ensures everyone is confident Iran has no intention or ability to build the world's deadliest weapon? That was the flashpoint that led Israel to strike Iran. And that hasn't been resolved, even though Iran's capabilities or program has been seriously damaged.
So yesterday, Iran's Supreme National Security Council said it was launching missiles equal to the number of bombs that the U.S. used. So that was viewed as a desire to de-escalate, despite the fact that it was still launching bombs. Can you explain a little bit about just the bombs they were using? Were they the ones that Iran was using? Are they similar to what the U.S. was using?
No, Iran's program is capabilities are much less than the United States. I just want to note, I have another piece that was published yesterday that might be useful for your listeners. So what Iran did was strike at a military base built in Qatar by the Qataris for the use of the U.S. military, as we requested. And it is our biggest military installation in the Middle East and South Asia. It was used for the Iraq War, for Afghanistan, and it is our primary base for our weapon systems, our Air Force in the Middle East. But what was really interesting about Iran's retaliation is that it was the same number as had been used against it. And Iran had given advance notice both to Qatar and the United States. And it basically said, this is our retaliation and it will stop against the United States anyway here. And this mirrors what happened in 2020 after the United States assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, who was the head of one of the Revolutionary Guard's most potent wings. Iran then struck a U.S. base used in Iraq, but it also telegraphed that this was coming and said that that was all it intended to do. So Iran clearly has no interest in accelerating or escalating the tensions with the United States, but it did feel that it needed to respond, even if it was largely symbolic because no one was injured. There was no significant damage.
The Trump administration is framing its action over the weekend as a limited attack, not an act of war. Is that an accurate description in your opinion?
Well, look, Congress is debating whether this needed a military authorization in the War Powers Act, and that will be disputed, I think, for some time to come. I think the Trump administration's goal was likely to try to take out the enrichment program that's buried deep inside a mountain not far from Tehran, a place called Fordo. The Israelis do not have the military capabilities, does not have the so-called bunker buster bombs to destroy the facility. So the United States went in and did it.
And these bunker buster bombs that you're talking about, do we know if they actually accomplished what they were accomplishing? Because Iran said, you know, Iran can say one thing, we can say one thing, but how do we know the truth?
Well, we don't know the truth. Mm-hmm. And another thing going forward is sending in the United Nations watchdog, an agency called the International Atomic Energy Agency, and send in its inspectors to see what kind of damage and to report to the outside world. The IAEA has been in Iran for years, the most stringent monitoring program in the world has long been in Iran. Now, Iran, in response to the assassination of some of its nuclear scientists, had limited the monitoring of some cameras in facilities. And so it's now kind of incumbent on the UN to go in and figure out what Iran's capabilities are now. There's some suggestion that some of its enriched uranium may have been moved before the U.S. struck Fordo.
You were quoted in a Politico magazine article that appeared 2 days before the U.S. bombings. The headline was, "Eight Experts on What Happens If the United States Bombs Iran." So that was 2 days before, and you were quoted as saying there is no military solution to the conflict between Israel and Iran. Do you still agree with that quote from 2 days before?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is never a military solution to any war to stop future hostilities. And this is where diplomacy really has to move in. And it will be in some ways the tougher task, because you have to get some kind of agreement between Iran and the United States that guarantees Iran's program never has a weapons capability. So absolutely, I think there's no military solution to this. The United States or Israel can go in and bomb site after site after site for months to come. And there would still have to be some kind of diplomacy to ensure that that the hostilities end and that we don't see these kind of open-ended Middle East wars again. I think that's what both Democrats and Republicans and Democrats want to see happen now. The outside world wants to make sure this doesn't become another U.S. invasion with an open-ended, years-long, thousands of deaths, military production. So I believe that quote even more today than I did 2 days before.
And so much had happened in 2 days. So Iran is a large country. How does it, 90 million people, maybe 91 million people, how does it compare to Afghanistan, where the U.S. fought its longest war?
Well, Iran is in many ways the most geostrategic country, not only in the Middle East, but also given its borders with several of the former republics of the Soviet Union, as well as Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's 2.5 times the size of Texas, just for scale. Gaza, where Israel is also at war, is only the size of Greater Philadelphia. Iran is twice the size of Afghanistan, more than 3 times the size of Iraq. It has the third largest oil reserves or energy resources in the world, and that's not going to change. And so it has some, you know, a little bit of leverage left when it comes to, for example, the Strait of Hormuz, through which a fifth of the world's energy sources flow every single day. And any ship going in, including the U.S. Navy, has to deal with the Iranians at its checkpoint, the choke point even, at the Strait of Hormuz.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides. We're talking with Robin Wright, an expert on Iran and the Middle East, which is the subject of several of her books. She's also a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Inside Iran, the government controls internet access, and residents were left in the dark during the attack on the nuclear facilities as it unfolded. Amandian is with a nonprofit organization that helps Iranians circumvent government censorship, and he spoke on Marketplace Tech on NPR this morning. Here's what he had to say.
You cannot go to reliable sources of news. So Iran has its own intranet network, its domestic national internet, where, you know, all of their services, banking services, financial services, postal services, they are served on those domestic hostings. And even in the past week, there were some days that even the domestic internet was down. So people could not even connect to each other inside the country.
Robin Wright, what do you know about what the people in Iran know about what's happening?
Well, Iran does have its own independent internet, but many people in Iran also use VPN to connect with the outside world. This is where Iran is one of the most tech-savvy countries in the world in kind of trying to contain information. At the same time, Iranians, the people, are also very tech-savvy, and they know how to kind of dial in. Now, there are problems of is their access jammed? Is it hard to make connections? Absolutely. I've gotten through to several people in Iran as this conflict escalated. The last couple of days, it's been harder. So he's right in a way, but there are ways to circumvent it. One of the basic problems in Iran is they have electricity blackouts because of its limited energy resources. So, this is trying to find out what's going on. It's not like Israel, where there are sirens saying that this is incoming, or there are bunkers where people can go hide to protect themselves. This is the deep contrast between the two countries. Israel is well prepared for this. Iran is not.
And we mentioned earlier, the U.S. is the only country with the B-2 bombers that can penetrate underground. Do we even know how deep Iran's nuclear sites go, whether these bombs could have even penetrated deep enough, whether or not it's been moved, I guess?
Yeah, so the issue is the bunker buster bombs. Yes, the U.S. has stealth aircraft, and they deliver the bombs, but the capability is really how deep the penetration of the bunker busters. So Iran's program is believed to be anywhere from 200 feet to half a mile underground. The bunker busters have their limits, but if they attack through the air shafts or kind of the outside structure, the inside structure of the mountain, but outside where the enrichment is happening, they can do severe damage. And so that's what we have to find out. This is, there's still a lot of open questions about what impact we had. The administration has made claims that the facility at Fordo was obliterated. What the world needs to do now, what the UN needs to do now, is go in and confirm what damage has been done.
So, right, but we need Iran to agree to let the UN in. Is that a next step? Is that one of many next steps?
Yeah. So the IAEA, which is the watchdog branch for the United Nations, will need to go back. And I think that will be one of the big issues whenever the United States and Iran get back to the negotiating table. There will be many kind of preliminary steps that need to be negotiated, then some principles, you know, of whether Iran is allowed to enrich uranium for peaceful civilian energy, which it needs and has a right to under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But the next big step is indeed finding out how much destruction and what its capabilities are in the future.
And what do you make of everything that happened this morning with President Trump saying that these two countries, Iran and Israel, have been fighting for so long that they don't know what they're doing anymore?
Well, in terms of his comments before he departed for the NATO annual summit in The Hague, he was angriest at the Israelis and used an expletive in this case. He was critical of both countries, but he was, in an unusual move, very outspoken about Israel and its massive bombing of Iran this morning.
So where do you see, just as a final question, I know you can't predict the future because everything is changing by the hour, but where do you see this conflict going? What do you think will happen next?
Well, I think the negotiations are key, and the challenge will be, how do you get back to a place that all sides agree on what Iran is able to do? And I think that's going to be harder than the military operation. The goal is to ensure that Israel and Iran do not go at each other again, and that there are means of, you know, ensuring some stability, as still awful as it is, in the Middle East. So, you know, I'm not holding my breath yet. I'm waiting to see if diplomacy offers us an off-ramp.
That was Robin Wright, an expert on Iran and the Middle East. She has written several books, and she's a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Amy.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and coming up, we're going to talk about Elon Musk's AI chatbot, and we'll hear about whether smartwatches are a good alternative to phones for kids. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
Public Radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Elon Musk has turned his attention to Grok, an AI that has been integrated into the social media site X, hoping to retrain it in order to appease those who see it as too woke. Smartwatches are becoming all the more common these days, and questions have been raised about how useful they are for kids as a stepping stone before a full-on smartphone. And also, the popular craft site Etsy is cracking down on its policy regarding computerized creations from its vendors. Joining us today to talk about all that and more is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So now that the worst of the fallout with President Trump has passed, Elon Musk is turning his attention to his tech assets, including X's AI chatbot, Grok. What is going on with Grok right now? Is he what is it supposed to be used for, and why is Elon so upset?
Sure. Yeah. So like most large language models, be it, you know, made by OpenAI or Google or you know, this one here maintained by X, the goal is to, you know, kind of absorb as much information from the internet as possible and use that to train this artificial intelligence to basically give the illusion that it is thinking, that it is making decisions, when really what it's doing is it's just using as many different data points as possible to draw, you know, conclusions that would be drawn through, you know, kind of relativistic implications. So if 100 people say that a pizza is best cooked at 350 degrees, and only 4 or 5 people say that it needs to be hotter or colder, all of that information gets absorbed and the AI makes a decision based on essentially what has been repeated by reputable sources enough times. Mm-hmm. It's not really thinking so much as deciding, you know, where to apply weight, to the opinions or published facts that have been made available. The issue that many in X's primary user base right now are having is that the information that it is, you know, that is being repeated by Grok does not align with their political, you know, interpretations.
So it seems like Elon Musk is having trouble with his own AI creation then. So what does he wants it to curate differently? I guess I could say that.
That's the idea, is to remove entirely data sources that Elon personally disagrees with. Mm. The argument there is to highlight things that, as he were to put it, are factually correct, despite what emotional attachments may be applied to it. It's not entirely clear where the emotional attachment comes from when it comes to the data points, especially when a lot of the things that Elon tends to disagree with, or rather his followers tend to disagree with, are sources that are captured by way of screenshot or, you know, kind of evidence that has been removed from X in the past. It's worth noting, in addition to this, that Elon has made it so that your account can be banned on X if you share screenshots of posts that have been removed from the site. In an effort to fact check, because it is impossible to determine that screenshot was not altered in one way or another. So they've just been banned entirely. But in a way, it also removes the ability to hold someone accountable for something that they have published and then deleted.
So this is confusing because of AI regulation or lack thereof. Who decides what's allowed and what's not allowed whenever you have this artificial intelligence determining not thinking, but mimicking thinking?
Yeah, I mean that's been the massive question across the board for quite some time now is you know what part of the software becomes the arbiter of truth? Is you know you saw this very early on with Google's AI answers where it you know accidentally told people to put glue in their pizza in order to get the ideal cheese pull, you know because that was a silly answer that had been posted on a website and Google saw the site Quora as a source of expertise and so you know had no other source to you know verify it against. This is a problem that all large language models have on some level. Because it requires some degree of filtering out sources that are just inauthentic, or satirical in nature, or you know, just an example of human language, but not human fact. And so this is, you know, an attempt to, in Elon's view, kind of clear out some of the things that he deems, you know, not credible.
I'm enjoying all of your pizza analogies, though, to explain AI to me. I appreciate
It's
that.
very clear what I'm going to have for lunch. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, are there these updates that Elon wants to Grok? Are they going to happen? Have the changes been made to?
We've seen versions of these changes made already. You know, when it comes to, you know, specific details, Grok itself will explain that, you know, there has been changes to its internal reasoning in order to provide answers that that Elon thinks are appropriate for, you know, for various questions. So this is something that is likely going to have to take quite a while because it's going to involve detangling bits of information that have already been kind of absorbed and, as far as Grok is concerned, known to be true. So I would expect this to be something that is rolled out over the course of weeks and possibly months and not something that's flipped right away.
So a couple months from now, if you ask the same question to ChatGPT, OpenAI, and Grok, will you get different answers?
You kind of already get different answers that follow a similar theme, but it is likely that the differences would be more substantial in a couple of months.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Tech Tuesday. We're talking about some recent tech news with Russell Hawley, the Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Moving on to smartwatches. Smartwatches have been commonplace for the last few years, and now they appear to be widely used on the wrists of kids as an alternative to smartphones. What sort of features does a smartwatch have that is appealing to adults to give these to their kids as opposed to a phone?
Yeah, so it really depends on the smartwatch. Verizon has worked with a company for a couple of years now to release something that it calls the Gizmo Watch, and this is specifically oriented at children. It includes features like geofencing, which says essentially if the person wearing the watch leaves a specific, you know, geospatial area, then the adult responsible for that account gets a text message. That says, hey, your kid has left this general area. So if your kid for some reason leaves school, you know, whether by their own decision or not, then you get that notification. It limits who the kids can communicate with. You can set a rigid list of contacts that can either be texted or called using those. There's also easy access to 911 in the event that there is an emergency. And it's just fewer distractions, you know, having the thing on your wrist that does less than a smartphone would do, you know, introduces fewer distractions within a school setting and allows for, you know, more subtle communication with the parent throughout the day in ways that would likely get them in less trouble in school than having a phone out.
Now, does it have a cellular plan? Does a Gizmo watch have its own phone number?
A lot of them do. Not every one of them. There are some that are limited to only Wi-Fi functionality or just GPS functionality. But the one through Verizon, for example, does have its own, you know, usually between $10 and $20 a month, you know, cell service that you would pay. You know, that is considerably less expensive than a full cell phone plan, you know, added to your account, and you know, kind of reflects the limit in the functionality there.
I can attest that schools in my area are doing a lot of work to ban cell phones. Cell phones have to stay in lockers. They're supposed to be off. And eventually, during the school year, they moved to saying the same thing about the watches. So is it, yeah, I mean, are we seeing, even though the watches have less functions, they still can be a distraction in school?
Absolutely. It's not uncommon, especially when you get to kids that are a little older in age, you know, kind of middle school and high school, where the default device is an Apple Watch that has a cellular connection to it. And that gives you You know, kind of all of the same distractions that a phone would give you, you know, because the Apple Watch has increasingly become more like a phone. And, you know, it's difficult for folks in an administrative setting to make a decision there, you know, between only banning certain watches because they can do more or something like that. So I can see where it would make sense to just sort of remove them all. And you're essentially have the same situation where the watch would live in a locker or live in a desk until it was, you know, appropriate to you know, communicate with that person.
The use of watches has grown a lot, though, in the past couple of years. I'm seeing more and more kids with smartwatches. More and more kids are talking into their wrist or trying to type short messages like, come pick me up from baseball practice. Are we going to see more and more watches on the wrists of younger and younger kids in the coming year?
I think it will very much depend on the area. I think that, you know, more affluent areas, we will likely see more, especially as Apple Watches become less expensive. And the SE variant of the Apple Watch is something that, you know, doesn't include the heart rate monitor and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. it, you know, it still does all of the basic Apple Watch things for around $200. So I think as more of that availability comes, it seems likely that we'll see more of that.
So that gets me into the cost, though. There are some of these smartwatches that are fairly cheap, right? Reasonably priced. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, there's one called the Gab Watch, GABB, which is right around $200. Apple Watches, as we've discussed, you know, come down in price. All of these are far less expensive than just buying a new phone. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, doing it that way, even if it is it's common to use kind of a downgrade from an existing phone. You know, you buy a new phone for yourself and your kid gets the last generation. You know, there are certainly ways to reduce those costs, but the smartwatch, you know, seems consistently, not just for the hardware, but for what you're paying monthly, just a less expensive option.
All right, moving on to our final topic, Etsy, a widely popular craft purchasing website used by artists all over the world, are cracking down on those who copy or plagiarize others' work. They're updating their policy. What sort of things is Etsy saying you cannot sell versus what's still allowed?
Yeah, so it was pretty clear from the language that Etsy shared that one of the primary targets of this are 3D printed toys that are really common across Etsy and really everywhere right now. If you go to a local farmer's market, you're almost assuredly going to see someone, you know, there with a collection of little dragons and eggs and you know, other little trinkets that are made using 3D printing techniques. And the thing that is legally interesting about how similar all of these things are is there is a small industry of people who make the digital file and sell it. They have a license that they sell to the person who has a commercial license to that design. And so they can make and sell as many of them as they want. That is the line that Etsy takes issue with, is that there are now many, many vendors on Etsy who are printing essentially the same thing. They're not doing any of the actual creative work. They're essentially buying a file from someone else, printing it on a 3D printer that requires very little in the way of technical experience or you know, creativity. Once that print is finished, it gets removed from the build plate and put directly in a box to ship out to someone. It doesn't meet Etsy's currently stated requirements for having created something. You are essentially warming something up in the microwave and then handing it to someone and saying that you've cooked it. I didn't use a pizza reference that time.
Oh, man.
That is essentially the argument here, is that there are, you know, if there are 10,000 people on Etsy selling the exact same thing that didn't require any actual creativity on their part, that doesn't really meet Etsy's threshold for selling something that you have created on their platform. And so they want to reduce how many people are doing that.
Now, Russell, you're identified in this article about Etsy on CNET as a 3D printing enthusiast. That's what it is. So do you consider 3D printing art?
I think that 3D printing is the base layer for something that art can be added to. Mm-hmm. So I think that it is, you know, especially in the world of cosplay, for people who you know, build things to look like, you know, one of their favorite characters. It is incredibly common to buy a print for something like Gandalf's staff from The Lord of the Rings, and print that. And then the art part, in my opinion, comes from the way in which it is assembled and painted and, you know, made to look like that thing from that movie. But the frame of it, the 3D printed part, is someone else's work that you have then taken and essentially plugged into a machine that is doing the work for you.
What about someone who prints a design on a Cricut and then just sticks it on a water bottle and sells it on Etsy. Is that art?
I think that that ends up being a really interesting part of this question that Etsy has not yet themselves discussed, because you can do very similar things with a Cricut. Where I draw the line as far as the amount of human effort involved, from my personal opinion, is that the process of removing, you know, the excess material from a design that you have cut on Cricut can take up to hours, depending on how intricate that design is, and then applying it to a bottle that you are intending to sell requires a fair level of skill to do without there being bubbles or tears or things like that. So it is materially different than 3D printing in the amount of work that human hands have to do in order to do something, but it is very, very similar as far as, you know, buying a design from someone else and, you know, having a machine cut that thing for yourself. I think it ends up being a really interesting line that Etsy is going to have to clarify sooner rather than later.
All right, we'll leave it there with Etsy because we have less than 2 minutes left, and I wanted to have the time to get an update from you on the CNET tariff tracker. How are things going with the tariff tracker? Anything new?
So, you know, one of the things that we're seeing in particular is some really interesting price volatility across things like electronics. You know, where it seems like prices are kind of slowly going up for a couple of different things. This may not necessarily be related to tariffs, especially when it comes to everyday essentials like batteries and smoke detectors and stuff like that. And I say that because we are a week away, essentially a week and change away from July 4th sales events. And Amazon announced a big shopping event that they are calling Prime Day, which is not one day, it is 4 days, and it's happening basically right after 4th of July sales would be over. So it is really common for companies to kind of slowly creep their prices up just before sales events like that, so they can, you know, drop the price down to what it normally was and say, we've, you know, taken this 30% off of this thing and have it be the same price. I think a lot of price volatility here in the next couple of weeks is going to depend on how much of that price stays after those two shopping events.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today. That was Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content for CNET. Thanks, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And I wanted to add, be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Instagram. Our Instagram handle is All Sides WOSU. You can see pictures from behind the scenes and get links to a bunch of different shows. So be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Instagram. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.